I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Like being buried alive. That's how BBC journalist Alan Johnston described his 16 weeks of captivity in the Gaza Strip. Johnston had been held by the small militant group, the Army of Islam. After his release today, he seemed in good health and said his captors didn't beat him until the last half hour before his release. Today, Johnston held a press conference and told of how armed gunmen stopped his car when he was kidnapped.
There was a faintly surreal experience, as if I'd lived it before, because I'd imagined it so many times. And there I was, before I knew it, on my back in the back seat with a hood over my head, and they were pulling my money out of my pockets and laughing. I'd been to the bank, and they had reason to laugh. They'd hit the jackpot. Off came my watch and phones and passports, and next thing I was bundled into this flat and forced onto my front, hood over my head and handcuffed behind my back. And I was like that for maybe an hour or two, and then they took the handcuffs off. And all the time I was wondering, is this one of the kind of more benign Gaza kidnaps where it's a family dispute and it's over in 4 or 5 days? But what I was worrying about all the time was that it was a jihadi group that had struck in August, and I was always worried about tangling with them. And indeed, come midnight, the door swung open and a guy filling it. It was clear that it was the second type of kidnapping, and I was clearly in a lot of trouble.
Johnston's captors were members of the Army of Islam, a militant arm of a powerful family clan that is inspired by but not affiliated with al-Qaeda. For more on their release of Alan Johnston, we go to Steve Erlanger, Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Steve, Johnston is a colleague of yours. You know him well. How did he seem to you today?
He seemed to me actually remarkably well-balanced and in good mental health. He was obviously fragile, much thinner, but I was so impressed with his fluency and his ability to speak in an articulate and analytical way about what had happened to him.
Well, there were some really terrible images. One we remember when he was put forth by his captors with a suicide belt strapped around him. The captors kept him in four different hideouts in Gaza. What more did we learn today about the conditions there?
He was kept in a very small room. The last three places, the shutters are always drawn, and so there was no sunlight, and he missed it terribly. He said he wasn't tortured or beaten, but from time to time, people would talk to him about how they might kill him countless times. He said he would go to sleep and dream that he was free and only to wake up again in the same place. And as the time went on, he said, you have to fight this feeling that this will go on for months and months and years and years. But he was able to keep hold of his soul very well.
Tell us more about the politics in the region that led to Johnston's freedom. As we know, he was taken to the home of Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh after he was freed. Haniyeh had been the prime minister until that somewhat civil war between Hamas and Fatah last month dissolved the government. Now Hamas in control of Gaza, Fatah the West Bank. Hamas was said to be bringing pressure on the Army of Islam group to release Johnston.
Well, Hamas wants to assert its control over Gaza. It has promised the people there security and stability. They've had very little of both. And they've said that they intend to bring the armed gangs and the clans like this Baghmush clan, of which the Army of Islam is a part, under control. The Army of Islam is a shadowy group, part of a large, wealthy family or clan in Gaza called the Baghmush. And one Baghmush member, Mumtaz, is under 30, and he's become more religious and radical. I think a lot of what produced this result was increasing military pressure by Hamas on the clan, including the kidnapping of relatives of the people who are holding Alan Johnston himself, and also promises by Hamas not to attack the Baghmush clan afterward.
Steve Erlanger, Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the New York Times, speaking to us about the release of BBC journalist Alan Johnston today. And Steve, I'm wondering, you know, as a colleague, it must be nice to report this news.
Oh, absolutely, because, you know, you always think, you know, there but for the grace of something. Yeah. Alan is a very dignified, very gentle, very responsible, very good journalist who has done a very good job from Gaza. And to have him kidnapped in a place that he covered so very well was sad, and sad to many Palestinians also.
And finally, good news to report.
Absolutely good news to report.
Steve, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, on this 4th of July, we have a conversation about American history that asks the question, is that history really a story of real estate? That's the angle historian Andrew Linklater takes in his new book, The Fabric of America, How Our Borders and Boundaries Shaped the Country and Forged Our National Identity. In it, he says, as Americans' boundaries were hacked out of thick woods and dense mountains, Americans were forging personal boundaries of citizenship to go along with those laid out by surveyors. And in his book, we also learn that Davy Crockett never had a coonskin cap, George Washington had spring-loaded false teeth, and if Thomas Jefferson had had his way, some of the U.S. states would have been Charonesus and Polpotamia. Andrew Linklater joins us with more. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me here.
Who knew that a story of surveyors could branch out in so many directions? Let me see if I've got you right. You say that the notion of the formation of the U.S. is this push west, you know, physical expansion, personal expansion, James Fenimore Cooper characters, you know, that kind of thing. But the real story is one of settlers yearning for government involvement because that legitimized their land claims as they moved west. And governments yearned for settlers because that enriched their coffers. That it, you know, there is precisely because the expansion took place under the government that it forged the American identity.
Precisely so. I mean, this is exactly why the frontier is so important, because within that frontier, there's a particular sovereignty. There are particular guarantees of individual liberty. There are particular guarantees that your property will be your own. And so when these settlers went westward, creaking in their Conestoga wagons down the Oregon Trail or through the prairies, they were looking, if you like, for freedom to expand, but they were also looking for cheap land. And one of the very first things that they did was that they made a claim which they registered with a land office. You can't have a land office unless you've got a government. And indeed, all the land which had been taken by treaty, but you may say a forced treaty, from the Native Americans was United States land. It had to be bought from the United States government.
You quote one of the settlers saying, I love this government. Yes. Because it validated them. As soon as, you know, when they could get that land registered, it became real. And on the flip side, they paid taxes.
They did pay taxes.
And suddenly you have a working government.
It's a curiosity that Thomas Jefferson, who is really the standard bearer for states' rights and the sworn enemy of big government, sets in position this mechanism by which the land is going to become property. He institutes the United States Land Survey, which goes out into the West, very often ahead of the settlers, and draws a huge grid across the states. If you look out of an aircraft window, if you're flying to the coast, you look down and you can see these lines running north, south, east, west. Those are the lines left by the surveyors of the United States Land Survey.
You know, it's interesting. We're going to talk about this great land survey and one or two of the surveyors who are just remarkable characters. But you point out that the thinking at the time was one of the reasons that Americans, newly minted Americans, could do this and take the land from the indigenous people, the Indians, was, again, it all comes down to borders. They had not defined borders, the Indians. They had not defined the land, and so therefore didn't own it. That was the thinking.
That really was the thinking. And I think that really, if I can bring in one of my heroes, Andrew Ellicott, who is really the person who drew the first formal frontiers in the United States after independence. He was a Quaker astronomer. He was born in 1754. And what he did really was to, well, if you think it, independence, there were 13 states. They all knew their eastern frontier. It was the coast, and they knew a few miles inland if their state border went along the rivers. But it's like the front of a house, you know. You had the front door and the walls and the windows, but there was no back. And so Andrew Ellicott really drew the back of the house. He drew the western frontiers, and that had an impact on two people in particular, the Native Americans and these Western settlers, because wherever he drew a line through the forest, and it really was, it was an avenue cut through the trees.
Let's talk about that, because how they went about doing this early surveying, it would take a couple of years. Over 100 people might go out on some of these surveying marches carrying tables and tea services, as you point out, and with axemen who have, there's nowhere to walk through these woods. Describe how they do it.
When he started work on the western frontier, western border of Pennsylvania, they took up with him not only about 40 axemen, and there was a university, a college professor, they had two astronomers, they had a mathematician, and they had the people to carry up all the telescopes and material like that. But they also had a herd of cows so that they could have fresh milk, because that was deemed essential to their health. So you're talking about pretty large sort of movement up to the top of the hill. And it's in the middle of the forest. There is no way. It's like being in the middle of the ocean. You cannot tell where you are. There are no given landmarks.
And he did, because he was, as you said, an astronomer. So a lot of his work was from watching the stars. Sometimes they'd have to spend 1 week at one point watching how the stars moved before they moved on. How long would it take him to do a border?
To take a single sighting and then make the calculations and compare those calculations with the Nautical Almanac, which is published in London, and that would finally tell you exactly where you were. Each sighting, they reckon it'd be 4 hours of calculations to align it with the Nautical Almanac. So if each sighting takes 4 hours, then you've got to have about sort of two or three sightings a night. You've got to coordinate those sightings with somebody else who will be doing it a certain number of miles elsewhere, so that you can bring the two sets of calculations together. In the very first year, they covered 20 miles in about 4 months. Hmm. Now, they got faster than that. And eventually he did, I think his best thing was to do about 90 miles in 6 months.
You paint quite a picture. I mean, not only are they doing these sightings, but they're sitting out there covered with gnats and mosquitoes. In his case, Andrew Ellicott's desperately missing his wife, Sally, who was at home with, 11 children or something?
Well, it's one of the great love affairs, really, because he spent a lot of time out on the frontier, and he spent a lot of his time, as you said, thinking about dear Sally, who was back home in Philadelphia, and he wrote to her a whole lot of letters, and they're wonderful letters, and she kept them all, and you can understand why. They're sort of fountains of love and affection and longing and physical desire. He says, my dearest love, I spend many hours awake in my tent dreaming of being back in your arms and enjoying the charms of your conversation and talk, which I think you can see them back home. And indeed, the result of his being back home is this huge family of children, which meant that he had to go on surveying, going back out into the frontier and writing more letters.
And go back out and literally shape America with the borders he drew. Our 4th of July conversation is with Andrew Linklater. His book is The Fabric of America, How Our Borders and Boundaries Shaped the Country, Forged Our National Identity. When we come back, how this history resonates in the immigration debate today. Also, later in the show, as we said, early Americans justified taking Indian land because Indians didn't survey and stake it. Well, now some descendants of those early Native Americans want some of their stuff back. That's later. We'll be back right after the break, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're back with more from Andrew Linklater. His new book is The Fabric of America, How Our Borders and Boundaries Shaped the Country and Forged Our National Identity. Before the break, Andrew, you were talking about Andrew Ellicott, the surveyor, who really drew some of the first American boundaries. It's really remarkable, the work he and other surveyors were able to do with just the instruments they had then, no benefit of aerial views. You point out you can still find some of their border markings. There's a picture in your book of the stone marking the southwest corner of Pennsylvania from the northwest corner of Virginia. It was placed there in 1785. And these markings were quite precise. You say that when measured against modern-day instruments, Andrew Ellicott was sometimes off by only 20 feet.
Yes, I think he is remarkable and really deserves some honor today, more honor than he has received. I think the other extraordinary thing is that he is carrying really the ultimate extension of 18th century science into the most primitive, untouched places. And it's that sort of the touch of extreme seems to me extraordinary. But there is one other difference I want to make, that there are normal land surveyors treat the earth as being flat.
Right.
And so it's relatively simple to do a triangulation or squares or whatever. The angles are flat. But, of course, he has to treat the Earth as a globe because it's over such large different distances. And so you have your triangles are indeed
curved
triangles, and everything becomes much more complicated. And if you try to draw a straight line across a curve, oh, the complications are phenomenal.
So he had a factor in the curvature of the Earth as well. I mean, it's just really extraordinary. Well, let's fast forward. 1890, a census comes out and announces, guess what? There's no more frontier. It's over. We've pushed as far as we can go. And the same census also alerts people to the fact that there are, for the first time in America's short history, if I got this right, more people from outside of the Anglo-American experience coming to the U.S. than the Anglo-American. How do people respond then?
Well, in a way that's pretty familiar to us today, there were campaigns really to restrict the immigration of people who didn't speak English. These are mostly people from Southern and Eastern Europe. They were Italians, Jews, Poles, Russians. But it's as a result of this sort of growing resentment against the increase of non-English speaking immigrants is that you get the creation of Ellis Island and the first sort of proper immigration and naturalization service. But the interesting thing about the census that you're referring to is the one that Frederick Jackson Turner quotes as saying that marks the end of the frontier of settlement.
And we should say he's someone you quote quite liberally in your book who had this romantic notion, this mythic notion that the U.S. character was created because of this push west for, you know, freedom and independence. And you and others, you know, you quote others as well who say, well, it was really more about trying to get organized and as we've just said. So what does he say now after this 1890 census?
As a result of the census, he makes this terrific speech in 1893 in Chicago saying that this is the most important factor in American history is this westward expansion, simply because that's the place where the immigrants and the encounter the frontier experience and become American. And as I point out, the frontier experience, in fact, is worldwide. The reason they became American is because the frontier experience allowed them to reap the rewards of their enterprise and self-reliance. They could keep their property. They could expand. They knew that they had certain liberties which were guaranteed, and that was not true if they were in Russia or wherever else. But what I feel is important is that it's absolutely at that moment when the 19th century, the United States, is facing the sort of problem that is being faced today of large-scale immigration. And people say that it is a danger to the identity of our nation. And yet, as one can see, those are the people who really introduce the new Americans, if you like, of the 20th century.
How do you apply it today, then? You know, are you saying that if, for instance, let's say those coming across the Mexican-U.S. border, they see that as their frontier?
What I'm saying is that once you realize the significance of the frontier, you do have to have a clearly defined frontier, and you do need to have control of the people who are going to cross it. Nevertheless, once the people are inside the frontier, they are the parents of the new Americans. And I can hear my English voice saying this, and I apologize for it, but I've lived in the States. I first came here 40 years ago, and I love the United States, and I really immerse myself in its history. And if you follow the direction of the history of the frontier, it points in the direction of recognizing that the people who have come to live within the frontier of the United States are the parents of the new Americans. And it happened from the 18th century when the Germans arrived, through the Irish Catholics, through the Italians, the Jews, the Russians, and through to today. And I know the problems are hard. I know that there is no easy solution to this. I only say that is the direction that the history of the frontier has taken and the way it points forward. And you can be certain that the same problems will still be there in the 22nd century and will still have to be solved because they have been present in every generation since the beginning of the United States.
If I read you correctly in a portion of your book, you say that these communities have always come, always been the parents of new Americans, always assimilated, tried to get land, tried to pay taxes, always the bulk of the population has always followed that formula.
the United States has always attracted people from abroad, and because it offers exceptional things which cannot be found outside its frontier. And that will continue to be the case. The liberty of the United States is a specifically American liberty. It cannot be exported. It is a very specific American achievement.
Well, who knew a surveyor's, an orange surveyor's stick would be so fascinating. Andrew Linklater, his new book is The Fabric of America, How Our Borders and Boundaries Shaped the Country, Forged Our National Identity. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for having me here.
And you apologized for your English accent. Is it rude for me to say to you, Happy 4th of July?
No, I should be delighted to let off a firework or two.
Thank you. Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, the No Child Left Inside movement. Proponents say this is the first generation of kids largely cut off from nature. Why that's a big deal and what to do about it tomorrow. Still ahead today, tea time. Back after the news, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. This past weekend, a crowd of protesters gathered outside the Woods Memorial Library in Barre, Massachusetts, calling on library and town officials to return a collection of artifacts to the descendants of Native Americans who died at Wounded Knee, South Dakota, in December 1890. The killing of 300 Lakota Sioux by the U.S. 7th Cavalry is widely considered the last and perhaps most infamous event during the Indian Wars in the American West. Here Now's David Boeri explains what's inside the Barre Library and why it's arousing such passionate debate.
Well, I'm going to have a medium sugar cone coffee.
In the heat of early summer, the rural hill town of Barre is far in distant season and time from the bitter winter of 1890 on the prairie of South Dakota. It was there, at the end of December, near a creek called Wounded Knee, that the 7th Cavalry of the U.S. Army unleashed a barrage of repeating rifles and artillery shells upon the camp of a tired and hungry band of Lakota Sioux who had already been disarmed. 300 men, women, and children were slaughtered in what the Army general later condemned as a massacre. Yet what happened at Wounded Knee so many years ago is in a way strangely bottled up and fermenting upstairs in a locked room of the library on the Barretown Common. Volunteer curator Audrey Stevens opens the door to a dim room once lit by gas lamps. There stand a half dozen museum display cabinets, crammed with leather clothing, moccasins, headdresses, medicine bags, sacred smoking pipes, amulets, arrows, and weapons called skull crushers. They're from Apaches, Eskimos, and most especially the late 19th century Lakota Sioux.
I go up there all the time, and every time I go up, I see something I haven't seen before. It's like a treasure.
Audrey Stevens has loved this collection since her grandfather first showed it to her close to 70 years ago. Just as teachers took generations of Barre school children up to the second floor of the library, while far to the west, on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, generations of children learned from tribal elders about the massacre at Wounded Knee.
At 7th Cavalry, they went in there and just shot them all, and they took pieces of them as trophies.
The great-grandmother of Rebecca Treestars was killed at Wounded Knee. She believes the artifacts in the library's museum, like the sacred pipes and amulets, were taken from the dead, and she believes should be returned to the Lakota Sioux.
There's still a spirit of that person's being that is captured in those, and those need to have a proper burial, get back to the right people that they need to be, so that those spirits can go on to the other side.
Mr. Littlefinger, how many relatives, how many ancestors do you have that were at Wounded Knee?
39.
And how many of those 39 survived?
7.
As a child, Leonard Littlefinger of the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation learned about his great-great-grandfather, Chief Bigfoot, whose frozen, half-sitting corpse became the emblem of Wounded Knee. How those artifacts of Lakota Sioux got to Barre is not in dispute. A local boy, Frank Root, went west through Indian country as a salesman in the late 1800s. He was a great collector, and he brought the treasure home and put it on display in the Barry Library in 1893. But where those artifacts came from, and whether they came from the dead at Wounded Knee, no living person knows for sure. Audrey Stevens has volunteered countless hours caring for the collection and showing it to schoolchildren.
I think everything that we have that was collected there was in that cache. That's what he said. That's what Mr. Root said.
Stevens believes that much of the collection came from a cache of the Indians' belongings that they buried themselves before they were attacked. And many of the items, like dozens of pairs of moccasins, appear as if they've never been worn, leading her and appraisers to believe that many of the artifacts were made for the tourist trade and tourist Frank Root after Wounded Knee. On the other hand, James Sullivan, the former town librarian who recruited Audrey as curator, tells a different story.
What did you know about him, Frank Root?
We bought a good deal of this stuff off the frozen field of Wounded Knee.
After the massacre at Wounded Knee, the Army hired two civilian contractors to bury the Indian dead. It seems highly unlikely that clothing could be taken from the frozen and contorted bodies. But Leonard Littlefinger says there's no way the Indians hid their belongings beforehand. Littlefinger says soldiers or contractors took the artifacts, probably from the Indians' wagons and tents, from satchels and suitcases, and hid them to sell later.
They were buried someplace, and that somewhere around 5 years later, the items were then dug up and taken to Cheyenne, Wyoming.
Neither Leonard Littlefinger nor Rebecca Tree Rivers have seen the museum in Barrie. Though Leonard was here in 1993 when the Library Association returned a hair lock from Chief Bigfoot, which Leonard later burned in a religious ceremony to return to Mother Earth. He credits the library in Barrie for preserving the artifacts of Lakota Sioux culture and for repatriating human remains. But in the long run, he'd like to see the collection come home.
I'm only concerned about the things that potentially are taken from the Wounded Knee massacre, and we have to arrive at that.
The museum's collection is said to be appraised at $2.5 to $5 million. But that doesn't matter to its curator, Audrey Stevens, who can't imagine letting anything but human remains, and she insists there are none, leave the library.
That's not anything we would even consider. This is part of our history. My grandfather took me to see that when I was a little girl. It's been there for all these years. No, I can't see it ever leaving, really.
It seems unlikely the Library Association in Barrie can ever win the argument about whether it should keep its collection or give it back to the Lakota Sioux. It's a small-town library with big needs and few resources, and it's up against the tide of history. After all, on one of the library's shelves, there's a copy of Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, and the story of the 300 who were massacred.
Here and now's David Boeri reporting from Barrie, Massachusetts. And we have this update. In response to last weekend's protest, the Barrie Library Association released a statement saying that the artifacts the museum has simply do not have any affiliation with the tragic wrongdoings perpetrated on the Lakota people, adding, the library seeks to use the artifacts as a way to spread knowledge and respect for these important cultures. Well, as always, we'd love to hear your thoughts on anything on the program. Our email address is letters@here-now.org, or you can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. And by the way, at the website, here-now.org, you can click on Archives, hear anything you might have missed, and you can download podcasts. Put us in your pocket this summer. Before we go today, no hard feelings. We sit down to tea with a British expert. You're listening to Here and Now. Are you hitting the road this summer? May we suggest a tour of America's best restrooms? When we say public restrooms, you're probably not thinking marble stalls and lace curtains, but that's the decor of the bathroom in the Vermont Marble Museum in Proctor, Vermont, one of five finalists in the sixth annual Best Bathroom Contest sponsored by Cintas, a company that supplies and maintains corporate restrooms. Cintas started the contest after a survey showed that over 75% of respondents said they wouldn't return to a restaurant if they didn't like the bathroom. Marcia Hem is owner of the Vermont Marble Museum. She joins us now. Marcia, congratulations.
Well, thank you very much. We haven't won yet, but we have high hopes.
Oh, just to be nominated.
Just to be nominated is an honor, yes.
Well just I'm online, by the way, and listeners can go by going to our website, here-now.org. We'll take you to the Best Restroom website. But I'm looking at a picture of yours up there in Proctor, Vermont. Beautiful. What do I see? Beautiful white and black marble, it looks like.
It's white marble is quarried in Danby, Vermont, and the other that looks black is actually a dark green marble quarried in Rochester, Vermont. It's a serpentine, which is a relative of jade, and that's our Vermont Verde antique.
You know, I see that now. There's two white wash basins, and around that, this beautiful dark green marble.
That's right.
Marble on all the walls, marble on all the floors. Are the stalls marble?
The divisions between the stalls are marble. The doors aren't marble yet, but we're thinking with all this recognition that we might even want to do the doors in marble.
I'll go for it.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, you're a marble museum. And by the way, this is quite important marble. This is the how has Vermont marble been used?
Oh, Vermont marble has been used in all of the landmark buildings in the United States, including the Jefferson Memorial, the Supreme Court, the U.S. Capitol, the Lincoln Memorial, Arlington National Cemetery, just it's a tremendously long list.
And so you honor that in your museum. But what other properties does marble have? I mean, why would you use marble in a bathroom?
Well, originally, back in the 30s, the Marble Company had a line of bathroom stalls, and they originally developed it not only because of the beauty of it, but it absorbs odors, it's easy to keep clean, it's sanitary, and it's a lot easier to maintain than many other materials that are used in bathrooms.
Huh. Well, now, you know you have tough competition in this contest. Again, we're online. Are you online?
Yes, I am.
By the way, do you find yourself going online to check out the competition?
Well, I haven't yet found how to find the number of votes or what the tally is, but I have checked out the competition.
And you're looking to see. Let's look at Fandangles in Flushing, Michigan. This is a restaurant. That's quite nice.
Well, I think it's really interesting because they are all individual, and either they've been nominated because they've struck customers as being something a little bit out of the ordinary.
Mm-hmm.
And whether it's the classic styling or the decorations, I'm not sure.
Well, in Fandangle's case, they've turned them into art galleries. They've got regional art up on the walls. They've got guild-framed paintings over here, it looks like, lamps.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a warmer look.
That's right. But you can also look at some of the past winners, even if you look at the Hall of Fame.
Oh.
If you go down to the 2002 winner, the Notre Dame University.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a bathroom that's kind of classic like ours.
Uh-huh. Gives you hope.
Yeah, it does.
I want to look at one other of your competitors because I hear the Jungle Gyms International Market in Fairfield, Ohio.
I've got that. That's pretty interesting.
Now, it's huge. It looks as if it has a porta-potty entrance.
I think that that's probably the thing that made it unique.
I would say. We should mention your other competitors, Catch 31 in Virginia Beach, Virginia, and the Mix Lounge at Mandalay Bay in Las Vegas, Nevada. Well, Marcia Hem is owner of the Vermont Marble Museum in Proctor, Vermont. They're the proud owners of the bathroom at the museum, which is one of the five nominees for Best Bathroom in America. And by the way, you can vote at our website, here-now.org. We'll link you to it. But only till July 31st. Marcia, best of luck to you.
Thank you very much, Robin.
By the way, do you think people come to the museum, or do people comment about the bathroom to you, or is it just something that...
No, they've always commented about it, but I just actually checked up in the gift shop there, and they said at least five people have come in and said they wanted to use the bathroom before they paid for the tour for the museum, so we're at least getting traffic in the bathroom.
Yes. You should charge.
That might be the next thing.
Marcia, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Robin.
Next up, the British are coming again, and again with the tea. That's after the break, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Long before sparking the American Revolution, tea drove history. For 5,000 years, China had the monopoly, refusing seeds or bushes to outsiders. Then in the 1830s, plantations came to India, tea in bulk came to Great Britain, and on to the American colonies, where women in particular loved the stuff. But it was those same women who led the boycott of British tea after the tea tax was imposed, a fact lost on Here and Now producer Virginia Prescott. Virginia recently took a proper afternoon tea with the man affectionately known as The Nose for his ability to discern the finest tea leaves. Giles Hilton is tea master at Wittard of Chelsea, tea merchants in England since 1886. They're now opening shops in the U.S., starting in Boston, the place where people once chucked the stuff into the harbor. But Virginia might have been a holdout that day. In fact, by the end of her visit, our nice girl from Concord, New Hampshire, sounded like a loyalist.
Well, the first and most important thing is fresh drawn cold water in that rare American thing called a kettle.
Now, this is one of those countertop, you plug it into the wall and it has a kettle on top of a burner. Okay, so we wait for this to boil. And is there a custom surrounding which tea one drinks at which time of day?
Any afternoon tea should involve drinking Earl Grey almost. In many, many English houses, it would be the classic. You would have strong tea in the morning, but in the afternoon, a lighter, more flavoursome tea almost, with a little bit less strength. We obviously measure the tea into the teapot. The secret with tea is to pour the water boiling into the teapot. Now, I think you should leave proper tea to brew for at least 3 minutes, if not 4 or 5 minutes. I don't want to leave it longer, it'll stew. And what we do want to do is take that little bit of time to really get the full flavour out of the leaves.
What is it about tea that so has captivated us historically?
I suppose the first traders in tea simply bought it because it was a commodity available alongside Chinese silk and various other things. Really, from when the English and the Portuguese discovered China, roughly 1615, I think, they saw tea. They didn't understand it.
But it didn't really take off in England, especially until the 17th century after the Cromwellian Wars.
Yes, the tea was a rare and new import into Europe, particularly England, so only the rich could afford it. So they took on this so-called herbal remedy with almost pretension, I feel. They certainly had very, very elaborate tea parties. So health and being led by the rich lifestyle of others drew people to get interested in tea and drinking tea. So let us pour that. And of course, what you notice immediately is the aroma.
Super smell. It's really nice.
No afternoon tea, certainly today, would be the same without Earl Grey. That is a blended tea, and then the flavour is sprayed on. It is the oil of the bergamot plant. Shall I be mother? Mother presides over the tea table. Everyone else is a mere mortal at the table.
So you, the man known as the Nose of Wittard of Chelsea, what would you be looking for when you're trying to pick out the proper blend of Earl Grey tea? What would you be sniffing?
Yes, I do use my nose, I'm afraid. It tells me a tremendous amount, but I get quite a round, warm, solidly bergamot flavour. There's just a slight blossom character hovering over the top of it. But also I can detect tea flavour. So certainly using my nose, the bergamot is trying to take over, but there's a tea character there as well, which I'm very happy to find. We want a nice, light, refreshing tea to go with our quite good sandwiches and wonderful scones, etc.
I'm going to try it.
It does sort of wraps around, doesn't it?
So well put. It wraps around. It sort of moves around the tongue, I guess.
It does, yes, because the very slight spiciness citric character, if you like, of the bergamot, just gets the tip of your tongue, which detects those sharper tastes, and the middle of your tongue gets the warmth and intensity of it. And then almost your bottom jaw has that lovely tea character hanging around there, of the aroma of the tea, the very slight tannins in the tea itself.
It's so nice. I'm hooked.
Good.
So tell us what else we have on this table for a proper... Do we call this a cream tea or a tea?
Yes, proper afternoon tea. They sometimes call it high tea as well. And it's quite a ceremony. The tea service does come out. That is the other thing, of course, setting the table. We have our sandwiches here on a lovely stand. We have our scones on a nice plate with little pots of cream and jam. It looks right, doesn't it?
And I'm just wondering if this is a way of life that is regarded as a kind of genteel old habit.
I think old established English families do still take afternoon tea. But it comes from every aspect of the class system, if you like. The working man would come home from the factory and, oh my goodness, he would have his afternoon tea, and he wouldn't perhaps have baked scones, but he would certainly have some cake, certainly have some sandwiches.
Granny's always raving and ranting, and she's always puffing and panting, and she's always screaming and shouting, and she's always brewing up tea. Grandpa's never left.
And tell me about these lovely little sandwiches.
We have a nice variety of sandwiches, light sandwiches, not some monster sandwich without too much content. They might be some cheese with perhaps a lettuce leaf, something like that.
With the crust cut off.
It is essential to cut the crusts off. We would hate to be caught chewing violently during afternoon tea. We must munch gently. That is most important. So crusts mustn't interfere.
I should ask you, is it proper to eat your sandwich before your scone?
There is, yes, quite a form for taking afternoon tea. All through it, you would stick to one tea. You wouldn't suddenly mix your tea. My goodness, you can't mix your tea. Oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear. But yes, sandwiches would come round first. But these scones were sort of saying, eat me, eat me. I could see them sitting there.
I have to agree. You know, these sort of look to me a little bit like what my mum used to use for baking powder biscuits.
Well, they look English. Not because, oh my goodness, they're small, but because the English don't want to chew a monster sticky bun, but it is quite usual to break your scone.
So he's broken his scone.
And then pick up a piece of it, put the cream on it and the jam, and voomph, in it goes.
Mm.
So, and then lumps of sugar go in after?
Yes.
If one takes sugar. I'm not much of a sugar drinker.
You'll quite often hear me almost preaching, you make the choice, you decide, and you do it your way. I have builder friends who have three tea bags in the bottom of a pint-sized mug. They leave the tea bags in. Two or three sugars, stir it all up. You think, oh, my goodness me. But they love it.
I sort of think I'm a tea snob because I use PG Tips tea instead of the regular old Lipton that they have at the coffee machine at work. But in the afternoon, I just go and fill straight out of the hot water tap, and I do it with my pinky up at all times.
Oh, that is a relief. Well, old Mr. Whittard said to me, we should all develop a little ceremony when making our tea. Now, it might be raising the pinky. That's fair enough. So I think the struggle we all face is finding what suits our taste, and the person who's done that is the winner.
Giles Hilton, tea master for Whittard of Chelsea with Here Now's Virginia Prescott. Wasn't that lovely? Okay, can I have a Coke? Cheese with a lettuce leaf? Where's my veggie burger? And potato salad, there better be potato salad. And we're having whoopie pies. None of this scone thing. Isn't this why we had a revolution? Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Happy 4th of July. And don't forget, chew violently. We are Americans.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.